Sam Bush, the father of Newgrass. What more do I have to say? Sam Bush, we talk about the beginnings and the continuations. And Sam will actually be in Cincinnati near me on June 6th, which is next Friday at the Taft Theater Ballroom. Part of the reason that I finally decided we ought to hook up together is to talk a little bit about that. But interesting conversation. Well, I'm very happy to have today on Unreal Bluegrass, Sam Bush. How you doing, Sam?
I am excellent, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You sound good, man. You sound full of energy, which is not a surprise for anyone that's ever seen Sam on stage.
Well, you know, it's the day we're talking. It's a beautiful day. I'm coming to you from Nashville, Buffalo, today. So, you know, it's finally springtime.
I think spring is finally won.
I'm ready, yeah. Well, down here it's going to be 80-something today. So yeah. We're loving it.
Yeah.
It's that time of year where we get to get out and go to festivals and see friends, and it's just looking forward to it.
Get out and do it. You know, before we went on the air, I was talking to Sam about, I go back to Poor Richard's Almanac, Sam, just so you know, I'm old. All right, I'm one of your old fans, and I go back to
as old as me. Then.
Exactly. So I'm an original owner of Poor Richard's Almanac, and that was one of those projects that, you know, of course, Alan Mundy. I'm a very pedestrian banjo player. I say that with all pride. I'm very pedestrian in my approach, but Alan Mundy is my absolute favorite player. So that album meant a lot to me with both of you guys, and I've had him on the show, and he's talked about that whole story about how you tried to find a label and. A label thought you were trying to fool them, that you were really somebody else. And
just, well, yeah, some labels thought that we had just taped an album and sent them, and they didn't think that, you know, young guys could play like that. And you know, and it, I looking back, I can be proud of the fact that we just tried to do something different. Which you know, it's not that people weren't making instrumental albums. Of course, the Osborne Brothers had made them, Monroe, everybody's made instrumental albums. But we were trying to do one where we incorporated the Texas. I mean, I'm not a Texas fiddler, but I was more up on that contest style fiddling then. And then meeting Alan, he was the first guy I ever met that could really play fiddle tunes, you know, with the same notes as the fiddler.
Right.
And art forms, a really joyful noise when we did that record. And I think we all had to take turns playing bass, although. I played more bass than everyone else, but if there's a mandolin and a fiddle, both of them on. If I played both, then one or the other, then either Wayne Stewart would have played bass or Alan would have played the bass. I think Alan did on a couple of things. But at that time, I was playing upright bass in the high school orchestra, so I was really up on that instrument as well, and so I was the main bass player. But yeah, I think the way we did it, we had two tape recorders and one had sound on sound, and you'd have to ping pong and go back and forth, and we set up in a living room and blankets hanging all around us.
It came out well.
Looking back, it was sure a joyful noise.
It's a fun album, and it's a nice place to, you know, and I understand what you were trying to do. And I will say this, Sam, correct me if I'm wrong. Through the music that you've played, and I know your background and everything that you've done, and that just happens to be the first album that I really caught on to you as a player. I know you'd played, I know there were different things before that maybe, but you were never trying to change or music or create a new, you know, now it might be loosely called Newgrass, but you weren't trying to do that. You were trying to play music that you enjoyed playing, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we were just expressing ourselves and, you know, just, you know, speaking with what I was doing. I mean, you know, what I see, I was 17 when we made that, and so I, you know, I was a fiddle player that went to fiddle contests, so-called national junior champion out in Weezer, Idaho, and won that 3 years, 15, 16, 17. And then, I'd always loved, mandolin was my first instrument, and so I still loved to play the mandolin the most. At the same time, I would be, I played electric guitar in high school rock bands with my friends, and it was funny because, you know, whenever I'd be in a bluegrass band or a country band, I would be by far the youngest guy, and then in the rock band in high school, I was the only one that was old enough to drive. So I was doing that, I was singing in the mixed chorus in school, trying to learn about vocals, and then I would play drums in the high school marching band and upright bass violin, sort of it wasn't an orchestra, but, you know, you're indoor, you're what they call the stage band.
Yeah, yeah.
In the wintertime. So, I mean, I was just a sponge for every kind of music. And so, you know, I'd grown up with Bill Monroe and Flatt & Scruggs, but then I'd, you know, when I heard people like the Osborne Brothers and Jim and Jesse and the Dillards and the Country Gentlemen, the Greenbrier Boys, then, you know, I got turned on to that new kind of bluegrass. Because they were totally, I mean, when you think of the Osborne Brothers and Jim and Jesse, especially coming out of Nashville, how they, you know, they were using their bluegrass instruments to try to fit in on the radio, and they were doing it.
Yeah.
And so I was always turned on to the more progressive side of bluegrass, but looking back, you know, I now realize what a fortunate situation I was in growing up close to Nashville, up in Bowling Green, Kentucky, but growing up close enough to Nashville to get their TV stations and to watch, you know, great bluegrass players and how the fingers worked. I mean, it was like having what we now have, you know, teaching videos. Well, it helped me learn to play a variety of instruments by watching television and seeing how Earl Scruggs' hands moved and how Bill Monroe made that magical G chord that I couldn't seem to figure out till I saw him do it on TV. And, but, you know, just and or the same way as when I was electric guitar, I was and still am a huge fan of Eric Clapton. And so listening to him in The Cream and hearing that beautiful vibrato he did, I thought that was done with a whammy bar on the guitar. And
slow hand.
I saw The Cream on the Smothers Brothers show, mm-hmm. or maybe the Glenn Campbell show, Summer Replacement show. And he didn't even have one on the guitar. And I saw this beautiful vibrato. And I'm going, oh, man, I've been totally wrong. I got to learn how to do that. I'm totally wrong. And so it was very educational. And plus, growing up in the age of the Ed Sullivan Show, you know, you got to see
wow.
the greatest of the greatest play live on Ed Sullivan. And that, too, was a major thing. I wish, you know. I guess the closest thing we have to anything like that now is when bands play live on Saturday Night Live. But, I mean, it was sure amazing, you know, to get to watch the Beatles and the Stones and the Jefferson Airplane on Ed Sullivan and all those great shows.
Oh, you talk about Jefferson.
Yeah,
Jefferson
but
Airplane.
To bring it back to what you were talking about. Yeah, I mean, I was just influenced by everything.
Yeah.
I loved all kinds of music. And I used to play, you know, for a while I played the snare, you know, in high school I played the snare drum in a country band, you know, a square dance band. And then later when the fiddler stopped going, then I became the fiddle player for square dances. And for that, I think that's where I got my love of liking to play long songs, because, you know, the dancers like it if you can play Ragtime Annie for 12, 15 minutes. So yeah, I got tough. Like,
that was the birth of jamgrass right there. You didn't even know it.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, yeah. And so, you know, long tunes are nothing new to square dancers.
You know how odd it is for someone like Sam Bush to say, I was really into the progressive bluegrass, and you say Osborne Brothers and Jim and Jesse. Now, today, when people look back at that age, and I recognize what you're saying, and most people do, but you know, you get into this whole argument about bluegrass versus, and I don't want to go there, but bluegrass versus newgrass. Well, it doesn't take long to explain how progressive, for example, the Osborne Brothers were and what they were doing. It was a whole different thing, and it really opened the doors, like you say, Jim and Jesse and those guys, opened the doors to everything else that then flowed from there.
Oh, yeah, and the way, you know, just, I mean, songs like Up This Hill and Down by the Osbournes, and even though Tennessee Hound Dog lyrically didn't appeal to me that much, the arrangement's incredible, and so is the singing. And sure, there's only one group I want to hear do Rocky Top, and that's the Osborne Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one group I'm really interested in hearing Foggy Mountain Breakdown by, and that's Flatt & Scruggs.
Right.
You know, and so, but yes, I mean, and when Jim and Jesse did their album called Berry Picking Time in the Country, all Chuck Berry songs,
mm-hmm.
you know,
Isn't that cool?
I mean, now it is, you know, people can praise that record and say, well, it was the first, you know, record done by a bluegrass group using all songs from an African American. I'm thinking, well, wow, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, really?
That's just Chuck Berry songs, you know?
Yeah.
And they did them great, and the way they did them, they, you know, I guess if we go back and listen to that record now, it probably sounds a lot more like bluegrass than we thought it did at the time.
But you're right.
Progressive things. You know, and they have Bobby Thompson playing with them.
Oh God!
It was a country hit called "There's a Diesel on My Tail," and so I grew up loving all that. So yes, it was progressive. And then the way the Dillards progressed as they went along with, of course, the first two albums with Douglas, and then the third album. That record changed my life. The one Picking and Fiddling with Byron Berline. I had never heard of Byron Berline before that, and I was listening to Tommy Jackson and the Grand Ole Opry Fiddlers, and when I heard Byron Berline, it totally changed my life. And so the Dillards, then the next record they made after that was the one called Wheat Straw Sweet, where Douglas had left the band and they got Herb Peterson.
Yeah.
Their singing became a whole different thing.
Exactly.
And now they're playing with electric instruments, and they're mixing in drums and orchestrations, and Buddy Emmons on the steel, and so the two records the Dillards made with that group, with the Wheat Straw Sweet and then Copperfields, I think those are two of the greatest records I've ever heard. And then Douglas went on to play with Gene Clark in the Dillard and Clark Expedition.
And
those are really great records.
You're right.
And to me, those. The Dillards and what Dillard and Clark were doing, they are the sort of the forerunner, that and maybe Sweetheart of the Rodeo by the Byrds. They are the beginnings of what country rock became. So, Dillard's
right.
Not only progressive bluegrassers, I think they've ushered in country rock from California, too.
You're right. And you think about, again, when we're talking about these things now in 2014, but at the time they weren't... people would think, this is the Dillards, it's another bluegrass band. They're doing the college circuit type of thing. And, they're just like, and they even made fun of their beginnings and whatnot. But when you really think about what they're doing and break it down, that was, and they had to be progressive. Versus the Flatten Scruggs and Bill Monroe, almost anything you did didn't fit that formula, had to be classified
right.
in that way a little bit.
And the Dillards and the Country Gentlemen, their show was, they were also entertainers. They didn't just stand there and play.
That's right.
They had a show. And the Country Gentlemen with John Duffy and Eddie Adcock, seeing them, that was always a real treat, the Country Gentlemen. And I just loved John Duffy personally. He was a friend of mine, and I just, I miss guys like John and Jethro.
Jethro. We could talk about Jethro for days.
I could,
yeah.
So we better not.
No. Listen, this is good. I like this kind of stuff. These are the things that are more interesting to me than the more obvious things that I would talk to. I could talk to you about Telluride, and we'll talk about Telluride and whatever. I know you're coming to town, but this stuff, you're telling me now, is more interesting. Yeah, you're coming to Cincinnati. You don't have to check your calendar. You're coming to Cincinnati on June 6th to the Taft Theater.
Ballroom. I've not had the opportunity to play there before, so
you'll like it.
I'm sure I will.
Yeah, June 6th. That's a Friday, so there's no excuse for people to say, I got to work the next day. So they'll have to come out.
I got to work the next day.
Yeah, that's true. You do.
That'll be in Pittsburgh, so I'm not working.
Okay. Somebody will get you there. Sam, let's take a minute then. Okay, we've described what all these sounds that you're pulling in. And like I said, I don't think you sat down and said, I'm going to form Newgrass as a music. You were just playing music. But how did and I know Newgrass Revival, the band itself, the entity, came out of another... Alliance. What was it? Bluegrass Alliance? Yeah,
we came from the Bluegrass Alliance, and I don't know the exact story of, what came down with when Flatt and Scruggs quit Bill Monroe, but I know that, if I understand correctly, maybe like the whole band kind of left, and Monroe got a new band. But Bluegrass Alliance was a five-piece band, and Curtis Birch had just had replaced Tony Rice a couple of months before this all occurred. And so the band was Lonnie Pierce, Ebo Walker, and Courtney Johnson, and Curtis Birch and me. And we just came to a parting of the, as they say in country music, we had to rip up the sheet with Lonnie Pierce. We didn't agree about the music and stuff. We'd just gotten in a spot. So, we wanted Lonnie to leave the band, and we found out he actually owned the name of the band. So, then we just said, well, then in that case, the four of us quit. It wasn't actually a conscious attempt too much to change so much the way we had been playing, because we'd been trying, certain things within the Bluegrass Alliance. Some of them would work, some of them wouldn't. And so, I just know that the first practice we had, and we weren't named Newgrass Revival yet. We didn't know what to call it, we just got into this jam, and then I guess Ebo, our bass player, started just hitting a little riff, and we would just play over that riff, which, you know, maybe it wasn't done very much yet in, you know, with bluegrass instruments, but certainly, you know, we've been listening to jazz records and Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers and, you know, records from the Cream, and where people jam out all over one without chord changes, and you play over riffs. And so we started doing that, and all of a sudden, I believe Courtney Johnson went into the melody of Lonesome Fiddle Blues by Vassar Clements. And so all of a sudden, we got used to doing these jam things and making little jams out of things. And we were also influenced by the band called Sea Train, which was Peter Rowan and Richard Green, their rock band, so to speak. And it was an incredible, incredible group. So we've been listening to them and the way they arranged, and theirs were almost like classical arrangements with rock or something. It was amazing. And so we were influenced by people who were playing out, and then we just kind of started doing it within the four-piece bluegrass band format. And and really on our first record, when we did the song called Great Balls of Fire, Courtney and I had seen John Hartford do that with Glenn Campbell on TV, and they did it in a bluegrass tempo, and Courtney even played a couple of the licks that John had played. I happened to make a tape of it that night, and so we were influenced by John Hartford and Glenn Campbell when we did the Great Balls of Fire song.
You know, and let me ask you this: the Allman Brothers, yes, I'm right there with you. And the other bands, when you say jazz, that's a lot. But what? And I've heard you play Jean-Luc Ponty. I've seen you break into, you know, like a whatever set of what I recognize as Jean-Luc Ponty music. What kind of jazz do you think was influencing you then?
I was fortunate that I heard Jean-Luc's first record. Somebody just got it, and I think it was on BASF Records. His first record was called Sunday Walk, and he wasn't using effects or any electronically enhanced things other than that there was a pickup on his violin, and he played with with piano, bass, drums backing, and that too was really mind altering. So, you know, I've had these different fiddle player heroes that, you know, they all play differently, and I loved them all. Vassar Clements, Kenny Baker, and Jean-Luc Ponty and Stefan Grappelli. I've come closer to being able to play some of Jean-Luc's stuff than I've ever could Stefan Grappelli. But, you know, jazz-wise, I mean, a buddy of mine turned me onto a record called The Best of Atlantic Jazz, and it had a version of My Favorite Things by John Coltrane.
Ah, yes.
So that was the first thing I ever heard by John Coltrane. And now I know that it's probably, you know, one of the most easy listening things that was the perfect thing for an uneducated mind to grasp onto, and how melodic he was, and the way he, you know, would play over the changes. And to this day, I think I hit some phrases sometimes from that, and so it's not that I'm a huge John Coltrane fan, but I was influenced, and The Best of Atlantic Jazz was just a various artist record, and that was the one by John Coltrane. So I really, and then when you think back to, you know, the first song I ever tried to, that I ever realized was in 5/4 timing, and then I, you know, maybe, and I learned the melody on it was Take Five by Dick Brubeck.
Oh, geez.
Same type of thing, the way they improvised over the 5/4 to 5/4 timing. And it's all cool, you know, I mean, it's all part of expression. So, yeah, we weren't trying to, we didn't set out to go, okay, now we're going to make this style of music.
Right.
We were honestly playing it the way we felt it, but with that came a lot of practice and a lot of nights slugging it out, 5-6 nights a week in bars in Louisville.
Well, you know, you mentioned Eddie Adcock with the gentleman. He was on maybe a month and a half ago. He and Martha were on, and you know, Eddie plays all kinds. Well, you know, he plays all kinds of stuff, and his influences are similar to yours as far as being diverse, but in a different, you know, set back several years more. But
right,
and I'm not a big fan, Sam, of labels of music.
Right.
It's just a problem for me, and of course you got to have some way to find it. But Eddie said, "You know what my dad said about music?" I said, "No." He said, "There's two kinds of music: good music and bad music, and that's all there is to it."
Yeah, I heard Norman Blake say that once.
Oh, did you really?
Good and bad.
Yeah, that's right. And if you just think of it that way, and all these influences you're pulling in, and then the whole Newgrass Revival thing, and you have to be, even though you weren't saying, I'm going to do this or I'm going to chart a course, you kind of have to look back now in 2014 and look at the influences of that band and your particular style of playing and your stage presentation as to what's come about. I mean, I you have to be happy with what's happening and with a lot of young players and a lot of young bands.
It is interesting. I mean, I like to drive around and listen to satellite radio because they got a bluegrass channel. It's just comedy. And I listen to all these different channels, sports channels, and bluegrass and country and the '60s rock and what have you. But it is interesting to me that what a lot of current young bands are playing and maybe a lot of them never listened to Newgrass Revival, but bands like the Wade Newgrass Revival and J.D. Crowe in the New South and the David Griffin Quintet,
yeah,
and the way we were all playing in the '70s, that it's not lost on me that a lot of this music sounds like that. I think the most recent trend is that a lot of people are following the path of J.D. Crowe in the New South, those records that were made.
Yeah.
And so it's neat to hear it. But about this, we always said that if you want to play Newgrass, you got to know how to play bluegrass.
Exactly.
First, you have to know how to do that. And so one must know the rules of bluegrass. You can hear the ringtone on myself.
A little bit, yeah.
I just wish I was the mandolin player that had played that.
You know, it's funny. Infamous String Dusters right now. Okay, they're sort of doing it. And Chris Pandolfi was what we talked about this a while ago on the show, and he learned how to play banjo before he even knew what bluegrass was. So it was actually, I think it was.
I can believe that.
Yeah. Well, so and he has a lot of musical skill, and it was actually seldom seen Ben Eldridge. Yeah.
Yeah.
And who says, go back and listen to this, and he started listening. Now he's gone back and still learning all those bluegrass licks that, to him, he saw, first banjo player ever saw was Bela Fleck. He didn't know what he was doing
right,
or why. He just said, that's an instrument I want to learn. So he learned to play it and then went back and relearned everything after he had some technical ability, and he's got the musical smarts. But that's just kind of odd.
Well, I mean, that was when in our Newgrass Revival group, I mean, what our hope was that, because, we would play Stanley Brothers tunes, and we would play, I mean, we even had a version we used to do of Oh Death, and it was just like arranged out the wing wang, and we had tempo changes and all kinds of things. And but what we were always hoping, or like if we would do a Bill Monroe tune, I'm sure we would jazz it up a little bit or change some chords or something, where now if I do a Bill Monroe tune or Platt Scruggs, I tend to want to play them just like them now. But that comes with maybe getting your own music over the years. But our hope was always that if we were playing to audiences basically my age, college age people, and that if they come up and they dug a certain song, we'd always go, yeah, well, you should go back and hear the original version.
Exactly.
It's really great. You need to hear the version by Bill Monroe. You need to hear the Flat and Scruggs version. And so, we were always hoping that people would look to the source. And much the way that I discovered, in electric music, that I would read where Eric Clapton loved Freddie King, Albert King, and B.B. King. I didn't know who any of those people were. So through Eric Clapton's interviews, I sought out B.B. King and Freddie King especially. I really love Freddie.
Right.
And that's kind of a parallel there, and I think it happens in all kinds of music.
That's the way it should work, I think, when you get exposed. Allman Brothers, you mentioned. I thought, what is this? Is this blues sound? So I started listening to, they talk about T-Bone Walker, and I went back and rediscovered a lot of stuff for my own listening pleasure. But you're right, that's kind of where you start, and you start backing up. Who influenced these guys?
Yeah, or the way, one of the first slide players I ever listened to was Johnny Winter. Mm-hmm. And then, once again, you know, Johnny Winter would talk about who he, you know, learned this stuff from.
That's right.
And they're here, and, you know, but yes, especially the brothers and Eric Clapton, them, when they'd cite their influences, or, you know, the way you hear, the way the Allman Brothers arranged old blues songs to make them totally new songs and their songs and mm-hmm. how great they. So, you know, you go back and go, oh, that's how the original sounds.
That's
okay.
Right. That's right.
To discover Muddy Waters for people.
Oh, this is great. Well, this is.
I've not heard him.
Yeah, well, this is good. I mean, of course, Newgrass Revival. We could talk another, you know, several days about the different things with that, and then the Sam Bush Band, what you're doing now, and I play all that music because I like it all, and I err on the expansive end of what should be considered something to be on what is loosely called a bluegrass show. That's just the way I am.
I just know, you know, personally for me, a variety within music is the most interesting thing.
Oh yeah,
and as be it as a musician or as an audience member, when I'm in the audience at festivals, I don't want to hear every band sound and have the same style all day. I want the variety, and I'm wondering if we didn't actually have more variety in the 70s. You know, when you go to festivals,
yeah.
You could hear. I mean, you could go to festivals and hear either Newgrass Revival. You could hear Ralph Stanley,
mm-hmm.
J.D. Crowe and Red Allen, Osbournes, Clyde Moody.
Mm-hmm.
And Roy Acuff and Smoky Mountain Boys sometimes would play these festivals, and so I think there was there could have possibly been more variety because. There is a sameness to some of the bands that, you know, when you see listed that a certain, you know, certain festivals like to have a certain direction of
right.
the kind of bands they have, and all of a sudden you find that a lot of them they play the same style.
You're right.
So I don't know. I like the variety.
I do too, and I think you made a good point about the 70s and the music at the festival. I think you're right, and we're not going to get into the names and whatnot, but I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think that's a point I hadn't thought about, but I think you've made it very well there. Listen, you're coming to Cincinnati June 6th to the Taft. I know most of the people in your band, but let's talk about who's going to be appearing with you then.
Yeah, well, let's see. I'll try to go in the order they've been there the longest. I feel very fortunate. Scott Vestal plays the banjo with us and has for quite a while. One of the things I love about him is that he can play as progressively as anyone that I've ever met, and his timing is so good. And then when we do a bluegrass style tune, it's just straight in the middle bluegrass, unless, you know, he just wants to change it up a little bit. But his timing's wonderful, and so when it's bluegrass, it's J.D. Crowe like, and when it's progressive,
oh, yeah.
he can he's seemingly limitless. But recording in the studio with him is just a joy, because if anybody messed up on the take, it probably isn't Scott. And also what he brings, he's a fine harmony singer from all these years, and in the banjo too, from years of playing with Quicksilver, but he also brings a 5-string banjo synthesizer that gives us when we're not playing bluegrass instruments, it gives us a Hammond B3 organ sound. He can do steel drums, pianos, you know, just
When I see Scotty play, I'm thinking, that doesn't look too hard, but then I realize it's like the first time you saw Chet Atkins play.
Yeah, Scott has the most graceful hands.
It's so easy,
possibly of any banjo player I've ever
mm-hmm.
seen.
Yeah.
They are so graceful and pretty mm-hmm. to watch. And mm-hmm. But yeah, so he does that. Then let's see. Well, good old Chris Brown and his Drums of Renown. Actually, Chris has been there the longest. I didn't have a banjo for a number of years when I first started trying to have a band back in 1996 again. So Chris Brown and his Drums of Renown. And the same kind of thing with Chris. I mean, all the guys, you know, I could say the same thing about all of them in that I think I'm really happy that we all try to play for the song and what fits that song.
Yeah.
And everybody knows how to play and burn up their instruments and do whatever is flashy. We all know how to do that. And Chris, especially like when we play a bluegrass kind of tune, I want him playing on it. You just don't notice him.
Right.
And you shouldn't. And, you know, too many drum fills or cymbal smashes will cover up acoustic music. So he's very sensitive to that. And then when we play more rock and roll or reggae kind of songs, then, of course, have at it.
Yeah.
And so he's a joy to be around. Even when we once a year we play at a festival called Rocky Grass out in Lyons, Colorado, and that's the one time we call it the Sam Bush Bluegrass Band. So we don't use amps and Chris. We tried doing it without him, so it would, you know, you wouldn't have a drum on a bluegrass show, but we missed him. And so he just he plays one snare drum, and we all put our wallets on the head of the drum. And yet, it feels much better with Chris.
Okay.
And, but he and Todd are Parks, our bass player. They both, you know, are college educated jazz and educated musicians. And so Chris at one point did 3 years, I think, when he was really young with the Maynard Ferguson Big Band.
Oh, jeez.
He worked on circus trains, and he's the guy that in Nashville here. He is about. He and another guy came on. They're kind of the first call jazz drummers in this town now. And,
wow.
And then, of course, the guitar, good old Stephen Mogin from up in Massachusetts originally. And when he joined, it seemed like I'd been going through guitar. Not that I'd been going through them, but guitar players would only stay for a year and then, you know, go off and make their own records and sing lead, as is natural.
Right.
So Stephen, when I met him, he really comes from the world of, he's first a mandolin player and a very good one at that. And so you're not going to hear that in this group. any rate, his guitar playing is just leaps and bounds because he really honed in on the guitar. But when we met, I knew he could play guitar well, but his singing was already like, wow, he's a really great singer. So and so he also plays electric guitar when we want to plug in. And he's become a good electric guitar player, and he too is a sponge for musical knowledge. He really, really jumps on it. So we got that acoustic guitar option or the electric guitar option, and then on our bass, Todd Parks replaced Byron House a couple of years ago. And you know, Todd is like, the joke is, yeah, he has 4 music degrees, yet he plays with a person that barely got out of high school. But And Todd is equally adept on both upright bass fiddle and the electric bass, in his case, 5-string electric bass. And, boy, they're not at all the same instrument. I mean, they're, you know, it's rare that you find people that can just really excel on both instruments. And he understands the bluegrass side of the beat, which is fun. And so does Chris. In other words, a simple way to explain it to people that might not play instruments is just that the bluegrass side of the beat is the fast side of the beat, but you're not actually speeding up. It just sounds like you're about to all the time.
I know.
The way the New Orleans beat, when we do that, it is so slow, you sound like you're about to slow down, and you're not. Or the country beat, right in the middle.
Right in the middle.
So, I mean, we all understand the different ways and the feel. It's more about feel. You're not
right.
Really telling yourself, okay, I'm going to play on the fast side of the
beat. Right.
It's just what feels right. And so I feel awful fortunate that these guys are so well-versed in so many types of music.
Well, I mean, it's a great band. I've seen you guys a lot bouncing around, and I don't mean bouncing around. I actually paid money to go sit and watch you.
Well, we're bouncing around, all right.
I don't mean like you're driving down the road playing. I actually go where you play, and I see you play a lot, and I always enjoy the show, and it's just there's so much everything. I mean, it's the bluegrass. It's like you do. You kind of bust out on some tunes, but everybody has that skill to make it, you know, come back together again. You just can't go out into nowhere and lose your track.
And our hope is that, you know, what we play could appeal to any age type, and it's really fun when really young kids, you know, like our band, and it's really fun when their grandparents are the ones that brought them, and you know, they're, you know, either my age or a little older, and so people can appeal, you know, this music can appeal to more than one age.
Yeah, that's great. It's great stuff. Sam Bush, man, thanks so much. This has been a blast. We could use a lot more time, but then we would always need more time to get into everything and break it down.
Well,
so we're going
in that way. We'll do it again.
We'll do it again sometime. Listen, I'm going to end this. Don't go away. Hang on for just a second. Would you please, Sam?
Here.
All right, hold on.